Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Learner's Corner podcast. My name is Caleb Mason, and I am so grateful that you have decided to spend a few minutes of your day here with me in the Learner's Corner. And today, I am honored to be joined by Lisa Jo Baker to talk with her about her book, It Wasn't Roaring, It Was Weeping. Now, if this is your first time listening to the podcast, you know, what we want to do here is create a safe place to have difficult conversations. Conversations that could be raw and honest and vulnerable, and where there could just be disagreement as well. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to get very honest and raw with Lisa Jo and talking with her about her story of growing up in Africa, her relationship with her dad as well, and the wounds and the healing in that relationship. Also, I love the subtitle. So the title of the book is called It Wasn't Roaring, It Was Weeping. And the subtitle is Interpreting the Language of Our Fathers Without Repeating Their Stories. Now, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, or whether or not this is your first episode, you know, we highly believe in learning on this podcast. In fact, I consider myself a lifelong learner, and you probably do as well. And that's why I have my Substack, where I give different recommendations, some of the best recommendations of the things that I am learning from, whether that be music or movies or podcasts, or really just it can be anything. It's just the things that are engaging my curiosity and are engaging my imagination as well. And all you have to do to subscribe to that is go to the show notes, and you'll see my Substack right there. And all you got to do is put in your email address, and anytime that I have a recommendation, it will be sent to you. Now, as I mentioned today, I'm talking with Lisa Jo Baker. So let me tell you a little bit about her, and then we will jump into the conversation. Lisa Jo Baker is a best-selling author with a BA in English pre-law from Gordon College and a JD from the University of Notre Dame Law School. Lisa Jo has lived and worked on three continents in the human rights field and subsequently spent nearly a decade leading the online community of women called Encourage as their editor-in-chief and community manager. Originally from South Africa, Lisa Jo now lives just outside Washington, D.C., where she met and fell in love with her husband in the summer of 96. Their story together spans decades, languages, countries, books, three very opinionated children, and one dog. And as I mentioned, she is also the author of It Wasn't Roaring, It Was Weeping. And without any further wait, here is our conversation. Well, Lisa Jo, it is so good to have you on the Learner's Corner podcast today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, and you know, we're going to talk a lot about your book, It Wasn't Roaring, It Was Weeping. And anytime that I have an author on, I love hearing the origin story behind works of art. And so I thought it might be fun to even just have you summarize kind of your journey and kind of some of the stuff that the book covers. And then also, like, what made you decide to write about your story now?
Well, this is a book I hope reads like fiction, but it is a true story. So it is a memoir. So it's my story. But my hope is the reader will see themselves in the story. So I grew up in South Africa under apartheid. And so that's where the story opens. I was born a missionary kid on a missions hospital in Zululand and grew up speaking Zulu the first few years of my life. And then my parents moved to the States for a few years. My dad got a degree in theology and then moved back to South Africa. And so the story really is this walk between two countries, South Africa and the States, because I ended up coming to America for college. But it also unpacks the tension, not just between countries and cultures and languages, but generationally. So it speaks to the relationship between my father and I, which has always been a difficult tension growing up. And I think there are a lot of us who we start to feel like, well, it's just too late. Like, that's just the story. That's how it is in our family. This is our pattern. And the book is about how do we break the patterns that we've grown up in. And so I use the relationship between my father and I to unpack other patterns in our lives, patterns of trauma or brokenness or injustice. hopefully all told in the context of a page-turning, gripping, exciting book that stretches from like the outback of South Africa to Washington, D.C.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to ask you about is, and I can't remember, it's not quite like whenever the actual, I don't think it's quite whenever like the actual like chapters begin, but maybe it's in like an author's note or something. You mention or you write about this thing that you learned from your brothers, and
Yeah.
they or you say, the person who gets to tell a story publicly sets the story
Story in
in some
cement.
in cement.
Yes.
And
Yeah.
so talk to me about that dynamic too, because you're telling your story. You're also telling the story of your dad, which impacts the rest of your family as well. And just as, just as that quote says, you're setting the standard for that story for what most people will think of it.
It's complicated, isn't it? And anyone who tells you differently hasn't really paid attention to how complicated families are. Yeah, my brothers are filmmakers. They own a film company in South Africa. My whole family still live there. And I will just say we have a great relationship, but part of it is because we had to have hard conversations. So when you write a story, everyone has a unique perspective on what happened. There isn't essentially one truth. There's my perspective of how it happened, but there's my dad's, there's my brother's, my step-siblings, my adopted siblings. So I would say, if you ask me how did I handle it, I would say delicately and slowly. It took a lot of time. This book was in process for 5 years. There was a lot of living and conversations and difficult, like hard frustrations. And my dad and I have been in process for decades before that. So I don't really have a one size fits all answer, but I will just say it's nuanced. It requires trust and care. And I think for me, I try to adopt a posture of open-handedness toward my family. So I wasn't trying to write a tell-all, you know? I'm not trying to call them on the carpet. I wanted them to know that. Like, I mean, this is a true thing, Caleb. This is a love story. It's a love story about the country I grew up in that is difficult and complicated and broken and painful and healed. And it's a love story about a family that was all those same things.
How did those conversations begin? Because I just think like there's things in I think almost in every family to where it's like, okay, it's maybe the elephant in the room, or it's the thing that you're like, man, I wish I could begin a conversation about this, but I don't feel like I have the right words. And obviously, just as you said, there isn't like a one size fits all for everybody. But I would just be curious to hear, how did you even like start beginning these conversations to take this in a more public manner, not even just, obviously the book audience, but even within your family, making it a very like more public thing.
Actually have a date I can put on this, weirdly enough. It was 2019. I know the exact year. Here's why. So in the last 10 years or so, I've written quite a lot in the parenting space. And one of the things I used to write quite a bit about and was invited to speak about was the struggle with temper that moms have. And it's one of those elephant in the room things that we all know is there, but we don't want to talk about it because we know it makes us look like bad parents. So in 2019, the big moms convention called MomCon, that's run by the mothers of preschoolers, they asked me if I would come and give a talk from the main stage in Orlando, Florida, to like 4,000 people on the topic of anger. And I remember I was standing in the bathroom one day, I kid you not, like brushing my teeth, thinking about like, what am I going to talk about? I feel like I've talked about this a lot. And into my head just drops this thought. You need to talk about what it was like to grow up the child of an angry parent. You have to give that perspective. I kid you, I took my toothbrush out of my mouth, looked at the mirror, and I was like, that will never happen. I will never do that because I knew if I was going to talk about that, I would have to talk to my dad first, because you can't go on a stage and in front of 4,000 people on something that's being recorded and people are going to comment on and not have that conversation with your parent. And if I was going to have that conversation, it meant he and I were going to have to acknowledge something we had honestly never had a real conversation about. And I thought I was going to throw up at the thought of it. I just thought there's no way. But because of that invitation, and then for me, this real sense of almost calling, like conviction, like I'm supposed to speak about this. That was it. That was the door that had to open for Dad and I to start having conversations. And that really then became the seed for even the idea of writing a full book about it.
Yeah. I also want to ask you about, tell me about the title. Like, I know that it comes from the song Weeping by Bright Blue. But at any time, especially like you have such like the title and the subtitle for your book are so good. I always just love asking people to elaborate a little bit more whenever it seems to strike me. And so can you talk to me a little bit more about the title? And then, you know, we can dive into the subtitle too. But it wasn't roaring, it was weeping, and what that means to you.
I'm so glad you asked. I'm so glad. So here's a fun fact. If you're an American seeing that title, you have often this reaction, wow, that's so powerful. What does it mean? If you're a South African, my South African friends and family who hear this title immediately burst into song because they're so familiar with it. They just start singing that chorus. So here's how it came about. In the 1980s, the mid-1980s in South Africa, which is not that long ago, right? There was the height of the persecution under the apartheid government regime. And what was happening is there at the time was quite a lot of international pressure on the South African president to change these horrifying laws where racism was codified in our country. Like over 90% of the population was black and were not permitted to vote yet, weren't allowed to be citizens in South Africa, were removed forcibly from their lands they'd grown up in and forced into essentially reservation style homelands is what we called them. Also, there was a gag order on any press or media from reporting what was happening. And anybody who tried to resist what was happening was forcibly arrested. And the president declared a state of emergency in 1984. And during that period, from 1984 through around 1986, over 20,000 people were arrested without warrants and held without charges for indefinite periods of time. And the secret police used shock, electric shock therapy, torture, all kinds of things during this detainment. And the outside world kept trying to send in people to ask what's going on. And the president wouldn't allow anybody to know what was happening in the country. And at this time, there was a young guy by the name of Dan Hyman, and he had been conscripted into the armed forces in South Africa, and he wanted to write a protest song. So he wrote this song, which tells the story essentially about the president and how the lyrics go. I'll just start. It starts out like this. I knew a man who lived in fear. It was huge. It was angry. It was drawing near. And behind his house, there was a secret place, and it was the shadow of a demon he could never face. And then he talks about this wall that was built, which is a metaphor for apartheid. And then how this man, the president, when the neighboring countries, come to ask what's going on, they stood around outside the wall and he pretends there's nothing to be seen at all. And then the beautiful chorus goes, it doesn't matter now, it's over anyhow. He tells the world that it's sleeping, but as the night came round, I heard its lonely sound. It wasn't roaring, it was weeping. And it's this idea of the lie that there is a fear external to us that we have to protect ourselves from, this roaring danger of the African native tribes that were going to come and try and take over what the white Afrikaner tribe at the time saw themselves as so set apart, and had written a narrative of fear. And instead, the song is reminding all of us of our shared humanity and that there isn't this thing to be afraid of, but instead, because of this extreme persecution, there's this deep sense of sorrow and injustice that is the weeping. And that's the political context where the song came from. And those are the years I grew up in. That's what I write about in the book. But for me, it had this double-layered meaning. I grew up under a father who was formed by this culture and very angry, very violent. And for me, part of the book is decoding him. What was underneath the layers of the roaring in his life? Who was he? Like, where was the pain and the sorrow that had formed who he was? So for me, the title works on two levels.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things, just as you were talking about the apartheid, that it made me think about is you write about how that wasn't something that was apparent to you, and if I remember correctly, until you came to, I think, DC. And then I think whenever you were around like 21 or so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, and you said that it, like, you didn't, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but you didn't notice it until your experience in America with other Black people as well, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, I think what I was referring to at the time is I hadn't thought of myself as white. Like, what does that mean to be a white person, right, as opposed to being a Black person, for example? So I had only viewed the world through the lens of my own whiteness. I had never really, and I grew up in a family that believed apartheid was wrong. It was bad. It was evil. Like, I thought all those things, but at the same time, I don't know that I had ever actually thought, what does that mean for me as a white person? Like, what's my responsibility? What should my response to this be? Until I came to DC and had some very unique experience with America's own racial story.
Yeah. Can you just talk to me a little bit more about that and how your experience in DC, like, helped you learn or better understand, like, your time in South Africa?
Yeah, I think there's something about being outside of our own contexts that helps us to open our eyes wider, to pay attention. So I was a young student living in a DC neighborhood. We were broke all the time. We were looking for a cheap apartment. We weren't paying attention to the context or the neighborhood. It was just somewhere we could afford. And the night we moved in, me and two girlfriends, there were a bunch of Black teenagers hanging outside. And we were trying to say hi, you know, we're moving into the building. And as we walked in, I just heard someone say behind me, "No, no, this is a Black building." And it was so surprising to me to realize, wait, what? Like, I didn't realize anything about the culture, the context, the neighborhood, the community. I had no sense of paying attention to the story bigger than me that I was essentially walking right into. And at the time, DC, you know, the unique thing about DC is it's the sort of seat of power in the world, like a global seat of power, of political power is how we think of DC. But where we lived was about 7 blocks in the wrong direction from the Capitol, in one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city, in one of a neighborhood that I hadn't had any frame of reference for. I didn't bother to pay attention to where I was moving. And in that singular question, for the first time, I thought, oh, what does that mean? And I had to pay attention in a way that when you grow up in a society like South Africa, where we did grow up under apartheid, where the white lens was the only one I spent a lot of time looking through, it was jarring to have somebody tell me essentially, open your eyes, pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about your time in South Africa and like one or two of the things that you learned from growing up there that has helped helped you be who you are today.
I will say I had that sort of eye-opening experience in DC, and I had a similar experience in South Africa actually right before I came to DC. Before I came to the States as a college student, I was 18. I really wanted to study justice. I wanted to be a human rights lawyer. You don't grow up under apartheid South Africa without having a deep sense of what it means to want to fight for justice. And I remember my mom telling me, the thing is, you can't, in order to have justice, you have to change the law. Like, the law is broken. Mm-hmm. We can't just help people individually. I mean, we can, but if we want to make like systemic change, you have to change the law. And to change the law, the way I understood it is you could become a lawyer. And the freedom fighters that I knew, a lot of them were activists or attorneys. So I came to the States to study law. You're going to ask, why would you come to the States if you're trying to fight for justice in South Africa? And it's because the systems were so skewed in South Africa. There wasn't a context necessarily that explored justice through an unbiased lens. So I came to the States. Also, my dad had studied in the States and I was 20, right? Like, I was like, that'll be a fun thing to do. But before I came, my father had organized for me to spend time with a really well-respected Zulu attorney. And he was going to work on a case, and he invited me to come along, and I went in his car, and we traveled 3 hours to the small town where the trial was being heard. But we drove through Soweto, which is one of the largest Black cities, or as we call them, townships in South Africa, a place that Black people had been forcibly removed to. And now Soweto is a sprawling, thriving city, but I had never been in it as a white kid growing up in South Africa. And as we drove through, I'll never forget, he rolled down his car window and he pointed outside the window and he said to me, "Look, look, look what you've done to my people. Like, look out the window." And I remember being so surprised by his statement and thinking, what does he mean? And how does he want me to react? And I don't understand. But as I got older, it's become a metaphor for me, this question, are you willing to roll down your window and actually see, like see beyond yourself to understand the story that you're growing up in? Because we are all growing up in a story bigger than us. And then ask yourself, what's my responsibility in this story?
That makes me think of a quote that you have in the book. You write, "We are all tourists in someone else's history, and sometimes it's
It's
our
our own. Yes. It's one of my favorite lines. I love
own."
that you chose that. Yeah, we have to, and we don't realize it until somebody else sometimes has to make us pay attention. And I think part of maturing is learning yourself to ask yourself those questions, not to wait until your story bumps up against somebody else's story, but to become more and more self-aware of what it means to be part of the human family and what our responsibilities are.
You know, I'd be curious to hear what's something about justice that you wish that more people understood or didn't look past.
I always thought that justice was a very clear equation, that on one side are the bad things, and on the other side are the good things, right? And I always want to be a good guy. Like, I want to be on the good side of the equation. I don't want to be on the bad side. And I always thought my job was to figure out how to balance that equation by canceling out the things on the bad side. Like, let's get rid of them. What I was surprised to discover, and I think it behooves all of us to think about, is that in fact, we live on both sides of the equation as humans. There aren't good guys and bad guys. There are just people. And in our stories, I share some of them in the book. There are some really awful things that I discovered in my history that put me on the side of the equation I wish I wasn't on. But I genuinely believe part of moving toward justice is being willing to be very clear-eyed about the parts of the injustice story that are in our family trees and how they impact us today.
You know, as I mentioned, we talked a little bit about the title. I'd love to have you talk a little bit more about the subtitle as well,
Sure.
which is interpreting the language of our fathers without repeating their stories, which again, it's just so beautiful for that. So maybe we can use that kind of as a jumping off point and just anything that stands out to you, and then we could talk about your dad a little bit.
You know, South Africa has 12 national languages. That's a lot. That's a lot of different languages and different ways to misunderstand one another. But it also means there's a rich, layered sense of what does it mean to understand each other. And so the word interpreting in the subtitle is really meaningful for me. My mom worked as a professional translator, and a lot of the work of our lives is trying to interpret where I come from, who I am, who I'm related to. So interpreting is a big theme in the book. And the language of our fathers, I mean, that means generationally, historically, culturally, the countries we're from, but also our literal fathers, right? Like our ancestors. So in how do we interpret, how do we make sense of where we came from and where we live and who we are and who we're related to? But then without repeating the stories, like how do we break old patterns? How do we look at choices or behaviors of our parents or our grandparents or our aunts and uncles or great great aunts and uncles and say, wait a minute, like I'm going to cut that off. I don't want that to continue into the next generation. So whatever the behavior that is, whether it's alcoholism or anger or rage or racism or sexism or you name it, what's that thing? We actually don't have to just keep repeating it. So that's what the subtitle's trying to say, that there is hope for us. But to do it, we have to be willing to go back and interpret our stories.
You know, you write about it in the book, but you write about the first time that you realized that you were a little bit like your dad. Would you mind sharing that moment a little bit?
Yeah, not a bright moment for Lisa Joe, but it is the opening story. Yeah, I remember vividly we were actually in this house where I am conducting this interview with you. This was the house we were living in here in Maryland, and it was probably, I don't know, 10 years ago now, 8 years ago now. And my middle-born son is a firecracker of a personality, super strong-willed. Wonder where he gets that from, like all these generations he's inherited from. And it's his superpower. I really do believe that. But he could push my buttons like nobody else. And we just clash. We're just like fire over and over again. And one day I just lost it. Like anyone who's parented for a long period just knows there's that moment where you almost feel like you're in a hostage negotiation crisis, like your children have taken you hostage and you lose your mind. And I lost it. I screamed at my 10-year-old so loudly and for so long that for days afterwards, I almost couldn't speak. My throat was so sore. And as I was screaming at him, I remember having this moment as I looked at his face and his eyes and recognizing in him my own terrified childhood and realizing as I was watching him, oh my gosh, like I am my father. And yet continuing to scream in that moment. And for me, I mean, it was like a big moment where I was like, wait a minute, like, am I really going to just repeat the story I inherited from my dad that I hated about my childhood, how terrified I was. And it was a turning point for me as I tried to figure out, okay, can I write a new story?
Yeah. Talk to me about that process of what that looked like for you. And again, we've mentioned it a couple of times. I know that one size doesn't fit all for everybody in that. But talk to me about, like, after that moment and you realize that, talk to me about what happened next.
I think it was the first time I realized I really struggled with anger. Like I think before that I thought I had difficult children, and everybody's children are difficult to the extent that they're children. Like children, they're not human, they're not adults yet. They don't know how to control their behavior. And I realized I had this terrible temper and that I was really angry. Like I hadn't realized how angry I was about a lot of things. And I started seeing a therapist. I went to a counselor and I remember in one of my first conversations with her, she's like, tell me about your family. And I shared some stories about my dad. And I remember her looking at me and saying, we call that abuse. Like that's the word we use for that. And I laughed and I was like, no, what are you talking about? Like, no, and listen, maybe I told it wrong. Like my dad is just like this really passionate guy. He's really intense. He's really for you. And we just have these moments that are every family has them. And she just said to me, no, that isn't normal. We call that trauma. And it's very eye-opening for me that what I had experienced is just normal. Like most kids think what you grow up with is the norm. Wasn't A in my childhood, and B, I certainly didn't want to become the norm with my own children.
So, talk to me about, like, what the conversation started to look like with your dad
My dad
about
and I.
you writing this, because, like, to whatever degree that it is, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, you're talking about some of the wounds that you received from him in the healing process, which has to just be, I mean, it has to be uncomfortable for you to talk with him about it and for him to even just experience that.
I mean, I don't know if I would have the courage to let one of my children write about me from their perspective. So my dad knows I'm a writer. I've written several books, and I honestly believe I get my gift for storytelling from my dad. He's the best storyteller I know. He's an incredibly gifted and visual storyteller. My brothers both grew up to be movie makers. Stories are in our family. So it helps to have that as a baseline, that there's at least some context. But what happened was I started after I gave the talk at the Big Moms Conference. He and I had gone back and forth where I'd asked him, I was able to say to him, I was asked to talk about what it's like to grow up with a parent who's angry and struggles with their temper. Would it be okay with you if I told some of those stories? And I remember him saying back to me, it was just such an act of grace. He said that he doesn't know if there's anything worth sharing about his life, but if it will help or encourage another parent, then yes, I am welcome to do that. But then he wanted to know what story was I going to tell on the stage. And I told him, I can't, I don't want to tell you. I was like, because I was like, Dad, I have forgiven you for it. And I feel like if I tell you, then it becomes a thing between us again. And are you willing to trust me? And he said he was. But if you've read the book now, you know it's at the center of the book, this moment he has and what he says to me. And it's so genuinely, Caleb, he for the first time knew that story when he read the draft of the book. And I was so nervous about what he would think. But what was redemptive about the book is that he and I have come a long way. So it's not like I entered writing this book while we're in the middle of friction and conflict, right? Like years of very slow conversations, voice notes, emails have gone back and forth. The other thing is that he is remarried after my mom passed away, and he and his new wife, who's amazing, they have adopted four kids together. And so he always talks about how the Lord just keeps telling him, like, get better at parenting. So he's a really amazing parent, like an amazing father of these children. And anytime I'm around them, they are like teenagers who are sassy and blaring their music and sassing him. And he just laughs. And that would have been a death sentence in my childhood. I can't even believe it. And so what's happened with him is that he has had these moments of looking at the kind of dad he is now and has profound regret that he wasn't that dad to me. And what story that actually opens the book in the prologue is he phoned me one day on the anniversary of my mom's death, just crying, so devastated about what a terrible father he felt he had been. And it was in that moment that I realized, wait a minute, like that's not the whole story, because you're right, it was bad. But when I think about how intentionally you have now worked at your parenting, it's remarkable. And my dad's 76, I'm 50, and he's still growing, it's still changing. And every time I see him parent his our adopted siblings with such health and such joy and such life, it heals something in me. So the book is really a testament to his willingness to do very slow, hard internal work. And that it's just not too late. Like, it doesn't matter how old you are, you get do-overs.
It makes me think of two things, one on your end and one on his end. The thing that you're saying, it isn't too late. You can always grow, and especially, that's part of the Christian faith too, that we can continue to grow and mature and all of that. And on the other side, you're allowing him to do that too, because sometimes we can just get so trapped in our picture of what the person was, and we never let them grow out of that.
They can become the villain in the story, and then that's all that they are. And I actually remember when I talked to my dad about how I thought I was going to write this book, that I wanted to write a story about South Africa, about America, about our relationship. One of the first things he said to me is, I'm really afraid that you're going to put me in a box and I'll just be like this caricature in the book. And I was able to say honestly to him, Dad, actually, in writing the book and all the conversations he and I ended up having is what took you out of the box. It's truly the act of interpretation, of trying to understand who you are and where you come from and what shaped you and what you were thinking when you did that. Those things are what took him out of the box. And it was the act of being willing to listen to his story and not just write him off as a caricature.
I want to read this quote, because this I w it was, and it's right it's right it's towards the end of the book, and it's probably one of the most moving things that I read and experienced. And it's a little bit lengthy, but it is so worth it. You write, "Perhaps the moment when I began to give my father for how he parented me was the day he stopped trying to self-protect. The day he laid down his defenses was the day I could draw near. And it wasn't just one day. It was a series of days over years, in fits and starts of risky conversations held sometimes over voice notes and sometimes in phone calls. His willingness to shed the skins he'd grown up in is the most shocking plot twist of my
Of my
life."
life. Yes. Yes, I love that you read that. That's exactly right. His willingness, because that's the greatest fear when you go to someone who's hurt you, that they're going to deny it, that they're going to say, no, that didn't happen, or they're going to put up their defenses. His willingness to hear how I had been hurt is ultimately what healed us.
Yeah, and it just makes me think too of in forgiveness or in reconciliation, it requires both of us in that. Like, and again, maybe I'm projecting a little bit or, but it's you want the relationship with your dad, but the thing is that it requires both parties in that. It requires both parties laying down their defenses in it.
Yes. I will say I talk about forgiveness toward the end of the book too. I have the last chapter in the book is actually titled Umusa, which is the Zulu word for grace. And grace, of course, is something we get that we don't deserve. And there's something about forgiveness that has that flavor, isn't there? There's this idea of when you forgive someone, you are forgiving a debt that they owe you. Like they owe you a debt of pain, like some way that they've wounded you, and you are writing off that debt is essentially how forgiveness feels. And one of the things I learned about forgiveness is that while in my case it was amazing that my dad and I were equal participants toward the end, there were years where that was not true. And I, in order to have a relationship, had to figure out how to forgive him. And so there's this degree to which forgiveness is possible, whether or not the other person participates is irrelevant because it is you choosing to forgive a debt because of the debt that we know we've been forgiven through Christ. And it is hard. It's not an easy, and it's not a one and done. It's an ongoing choice to lay down the debt that's owed to you, because of your own debt having been paid, having been forgiven by Christ. So forgiveness was a long and ongoing process that felt like I was the one who had to keep writing off these huge debts owed me until we got to a place where my father, Christ, had worked enough in his life that he was actually able to acknowledge the debt. Like that's what's that is very powerful for him to acknowledge how I had had to forgive him and for him to ask for forgiveness. And even though there are a lot of places, many times over the years, he's asked for forgiveness, what was incredibly tender about the book is he read the whole thing. He was involved the whole way. I have hundreds of voice notes. He remember, we did this. I would ask him to remember with me because, as a child, you remember things and you're like, why did that happen? That was so weird. Where were we going? And so he and I would have these long conversations where we would remember together. But then he read the whole manuscript, and what was very tender is that he would leave me voice notes after each chapter, acknowledging like what he had read or how hard it was, or saying sorry again, or being so moved. So it was a completely unexpected part of the journey, to get to live that story of forgiveness together.
Well, I got two other things I want to ask you about, but before that, is there anything that we haven't covered or talk about that you want to make sure that we talk about?
I just have to say, I love so much that you're pulling quotes from the book and that
Oh,
there are
well, thank you.
stories that hit you. I think, no, I have a question for you. I always love to know for the reader, like what was it? Was there a certain part of the story that really stood out to you or that you loved or that moved you, that has stuck with you?
Yeah, I honestly I think it's that forgiveness part that we just talked about right there. And that whole section of your book is probably the most meaningful part for me. And like whenever I think about like one of my like my takeaways from this book, the thing that's going to resonate with me, it's probably that section right
Oh,
there.
that's so meaningful. I'm so glad.
Okay, well two other things I want to ask you about. One is talk to me about your dad and just your gratitude for him. And I'll let you take that anywhere that you want to. But like one of the things, and again, I feel like we've done a pretty good job of this. But you're like sometimes in conversations like this, and I don't feel like we've done this, it can slant towards the negative of like, hey, this is how things were in the past. But talk to me about your gratitude for him.
I'm so glad you asked that. I mean, I just love him so much. And I think it's why, you know, in the beginning of the conversation, you asked why now with the book. Mm-hmm. Well, it's because I'm not angry anymore. Like, I'm not hurt. I'm not wounded. I feel whole and healed. And not just because of the change in my dad, but because of the work Christ has done in me. But I can genuinely say the book was written out of a place of such deep love for him. He's our biggest champion. He is a great grandpa, but an amazing dad who is, I mean, he really is like a character out of a movie. You know, he told me when he was reading the book, he's like, I feel like you're making me this some larger than life character that I'm not. I'm like, Dad, you grew up on like a third generation sheep farm. You hunted snakes. You sold them for pocket money. Like you hunted baboons. Like you went horse riding. You canoed down the entire Orange River. Like your life is a movie. What are you? And he was supposed to go, oh, Lisa Jo, it's just boring from the inside. And I'm just like, that is not true. So he's just a passionate, and he is sold for Jesus. On days when my faith wavers, I have nothing other than Christ to explain the change in my father's life. Nothing. Mm-hmm. And we can't make people change. We can't manipulate them into change. We can't guilt them into change. We can't cry them into change. They have to change. And the Holy Spirit came and did work in my dad's life, and he slowly changed over years. So he's a delight. He's up for anything. He's gone skydiving with my brothers. We went swimming with elephants the last time I was home in South Africa. Like, there's nothing average about him. He's a medical doctor, speaks three languages. He's done generations of patients. He once sewed up his own hand after he was in an ice skating accident. So he's that kind of person.
Yeah. And the last thing is, and I know that we've touched on this a little bit, but talk to me about what you learned about Jesus just through this.
Man, what a great question. I think I learned a lot more about grace, this idea of what we don't deserve, and how Jesus is he's so determined to almost obscenely offer us grace and forgiveness, that he is always revisiting the parts of our story that we think are over. And I think that's, as someone who loves words, as a writer, I love about Jesus is somehow he's able to time travel back in history to the most painful parts of your story. And if you are willing, if you'll let him, he will get into them and then pick at those plot points and then them forward to the future and create moments of healing. And it's not that he's fixing what got broken, but he's the God who says he makes all things new, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is really the part that surprised me most, his ability to continue to make things new. So much so, when this book started, it was such a source of tension in my family. Nobody knew what I was going to write. They're so nervous about it. But because of the book, because I was doing this work of trying to understand the story, I ended up having conversations with my brothers about things we've never talked about. And there was such deep healing from my childhood, from their childhood, and then learning from them about what forgiveness means and how what it's looked like when they gave it to my dad. So I was just fascinated by a Jesus who basically left like no plot point unresolved in the story.
Mm. Oh man, I love that imagery that you just said, no plot point unresolved in the story.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, Lisa Jo, I know that people are going to want to keep up with you and get your book. Where's the best place for people to go to do those things?
Yeah, I'm just Lisa Jo Baker in all the places. No E on the Jo, Lisa Jo Baker at Instagram, at Facebook. I'm really not on Twitter anymore, but lisajobaker.com is the blog. And I love connecting with people. I mean, I genuinely invite your listeners, if you've read the book, if you send me a direct message, I almost always respond because I just love this. Listen, I was in this book for 5 years. So when people read it now, I'm like dying to talk to them about it. It's so much fun for me.
Oh, awesome. Well, Lisa Jo, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. Thanks for the great conversation. And just thank you for doing the work and for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for such great questions.
So coming out of that conversation, I really want to hit on three things that stand out to me from it. One is just this idea of us allowing people to change. that nobody is set in stone, no matter how hard and horrible our experience was with them. They can continue to learn and grow. And again, you know, for myself as a follower of Jesus, and if you consider yourself a follower of Jesus, that is one of the ways that we love people, is we allow them to grow. We allow them to mature, and that what they did does not have the final say over who that person is. And, you know, there's lots of other things that get into it, you know, boundaries and reconciliation and figuring out all of that stuff. But that doesn't negate the principle that people can change and we need to allow them to change. So that's the first thing. The second thing is what she was talking about, that often God revisits the pain points in our life, revisits different parts of our story, and we could continue to find new forms of redemption, and that continue to find new areas that need healing and where we can experience healing as well. And oftentimes it could take years. Sometimes we don't realize the full impact. And honestly, I'm not sure that we can, at least until heaven, because we can understand a vast degree of the hurt, but I don't know if we can actually understand the full impact that other people's actions have had on us. We might be able to get pretty close, but it's hard to separate all those things out. And I think that's why that those things continue to have effect to have an effect on us. And I think that's why Jesus continues to revisit them with us and help us to continue to experience healing in those experiences as well. And the last thing that really stands out to me is just this idea that she, like literally one of the last things that she said, is that God does not allow any plot point to be unresolved. And, you know, I've really been thinking a lot about stories recently, particularly fiction stories. And at different times, you know, you can wonder, okay, did the author forget this plot? Did things just drop off? Is this ever going to be picked up again? And especially in long form storytelling, which can, you know, happen over years, we can believe that. We can believe that plots have been dropped, that they're never going to come back and revisit this. But that's not God. That's not Jesus. That's not the Holy Spirit. Every plot point is resolved. No plot point goes unresolved. And hopefully you can take courage and that you can be encouraged by that. So those are really my three takeaways from this, that people can change, that Jesus often wants to revisit our story to help us experience greater healing, and that no plot point will go unresolved in our life. So those are some of the things that I'm learning from. If you want to continue to learn from me, please subscribe to my Substack, to where I give different recommendations of some of the things that I am learning from. And again, all you got to do is type in your email, and it will get sent to you every time that I have something great that I am recommending as well. So with that, that's all that I have for today. I do want to say thank you to Sam Massey for creating the music for this podcast. Thank you to Lisa Joe for being on the podcast as well in the great conversation. And thank you for listening all the way to the end of the episode. My name is Caleb Mason. And until next time, keep learning and keep growing.